Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2395. Delighted to have Richard Hanania back on the show, and he is here with a brand new book just out this week from HarperCollins, The Origins of Woke, Civil Rights Law, Corporate America, and the Triumph of Identity Politics. And Richard, before I sort of officially bring you on, I want to say that there may be some weary viewers who think, oh, woke again, I've heard a lot about this, but you have not heard the Richard Hanania thesis, which is quite different from what you're going to hear from a lot of other people. And I personally think it's much more convincing. And it also happens to be, in a way, a simpler explanation than some of the highfalutin accounts for how we got here. So Richard, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Tom. And yeah, I understand the wariness with the debate. It seems like, especially if you're on Twitter, if you're on social media, it seems to dominate our political discourse. And I've been paying attention to this for a while, and it's just so repetitive. I mean, the left talks about inequality and the right talks about free speech is not racist. That's how we get a truth. And, you know, it's the same thing over and over. And if I was just going to write, you know, I wouldn't write another book like that because I think that market is completely saturated. I mean, yeah. Even like the cultural Marxists, looking back at Marcuse, Adorno, all these guys, Foucault, like that's been done. Yeah. So my thesis is something different. It's a simpler explanation. I think it's a more convincing explanation. I think what people will find in this book is it's rare of a book of this kind. It's an ambitious book in that it tries to go from a few laws towards big picture sort of changes in American governments and changes in American culture. So I think people, if you're sick of the wokeness debate, like read this book and then never think about the wokeness debate again, because I think I answer a lot of the questions and I bring something new and I tell you know, how we got here and what to do about it. So I think that like, this could be sort of like the capstone of a lifetime of paying attention to wokeness.
Well, it helped me a lot. I definitely feel like I've got a better grasp on it because I think I more or less had gone for theses that you pretty convincingly reject in here. So for example, you're saying that wokeness, if we're going to look for the origins of it, we should look to a source that's a bit more mundane than trying to dig out philosophers from generations ago and saying, they led us inexorably to this point and the end point of their thought is wokeness. It has more mundane origins in civil rights law, yes, but really more in the interpretations of civil rights law in the way it's been manipulated by bureaucracies and human resource departments. Well, first of all, I want you to just make sure I'm stating that correctly. And then I want to jump immediately into the Bakke case because there's something I want to ask you about.
You read these books and it's like, okay, there's this guy named Marx or this guy named Marcuse and he says X and now the government does, you know, X. And it's the same thing. It's just sort of a progression. And that really doesn't explain anything. Like, how do you know this philosopher actually mattered? Like, how do we know if Marcuse never existed that our world would be any different? I don't think we know with certainty. You know, I think my friend Rufo wrote a book looking at these philosophers, and I'm convinced that they matter somewhat. My argument is that you don't need that sort of complicated theory that's still unexplained, like how we got from what's on the page of these obscure philosophers. They're not that obscure. I mean, they do influence some people, to just like remaking society. And because you don't need all that because you have these things in government, right? You have the government going to businesses and saying, if blacks don't do as well as on a test, that's, you know, you're presumptively racist. If you don't have enough women, we're coming after you. After a while, what did every corporation, every business start to say to government and say to the rest of the world? They said, you know, we are the wokest. We are the least racist. We have training programs. Please, for the love of God, after decades of being sued and, you know, giving millions of dollars in settlement and seeking these government contracts, they eventually became sort of captured entities. The same things with the universities. You can trace these. This is why the history, this is maybe like 50% a history book. You can trace the history and see like the government action comes before the institution flips. You could see that again and again. You can see that with race consciousness in colleges and universities. The universities originally were resistant to them. You can see it in corporate America too, where the disparate impact standard and these broad interpretations of civil rights law came before, you know, what we call woke capital. So I think just the chronology that I put together there is it's just very convincing.
Well, and also toward the end, you have an interesting bit of ecumenical outreach in which you say, we have a divergence of thought on the right now with some people saying, look, laissez-faire is not good enough. We got to take the battle to our enemies and we need a state that'll go out and do that. And then on the other hand, you have more laissez-faire people. And your argument is, well, look, if wokeness is coming from the penumbras of civil rights laws, coming from the state, and it's not really coming from these philosophers, then both of these groups can unite, because the laissez-faire people want to go against the state and the other people want to go against wokeness, which is coming from the state. So we could all sit together in happy concord as we march against this problem.
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced that any conservative who reads my book, from Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney to Donald Trump or DeSantis or even extreme right-wing people, I mean, I just think there's such, a lot of people on the left are not going to like it. But, you know, there are real disagreements between like libertarians and nationalists and statists. This doesn't have to be one of them, right? There doesn't, everything that I say we should do is completely consistent with libertarianism, and it's completely consistent with, you know, what the average Fox News viewer, what like your national conservative is getting upset about. So that's why I think I'm pushing out an open door. I think like people will take the ideas here and run with them.
All right, let's talk about that Bakke case, because there's something very odd at the heart of it. I think it's 1978. And it has to do with admission to medical school in the University of California system. What exactly happened?
Yeah, it was the University of California. I think it was California, Davis.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this white guy just doesn't get in. And basically, you know, it's a regular affirmative action case. We've had a handful of Supreme Court cases since then. And, you know, they rule that he, you know, this is where the diversity justification comes from. So, you know, the conservatives at the court say no racial preferences. The liberals, they say racial quotas. The liberals on the court, Justice Powell, says no quotas. That's too explicit for the Constitution or the Civil Rights Act. But diversity, a plus factor in diversity. It's the most intellectually coherent. The conservatives and liberal sides were both more intellectually coherent. But this ended up dominating just because he happened to be the most moderate judge on the court.
So the result is this very unsettled kind of answer that no, you shouldn't have quotas, but yes, you can take race into account. And we'll leave you to figure out what that means.
Yeah. And that's, and that was, that applied just to the university's admissions, but that then became the rule everywhere. The rule everywhere is if any corporation said in 1995 or 2005 or whatever, we're going to have 15% blacks, 10% Hispanics, whatever, we're going to have these quotas, that would be pretty much illegal. Like you even like before, like conservatives were suing over civil rights law, that was, you couldn't even do that. You couldn't be colorblind either, because if you give a test, anything, you have to keep, the government tells you to keep statistics. How do they know you're being fair if you don't keep the statistics and you don't show that, like, how many people are, you know, getting hired at each stage or who's getting promoted? So you need the statistics. You can't give quotas, but make sure your numbers, it's like a checkbook. It's like, don't add and subtract also, but we're going to check and make sure the check is balanced at like the end of the month. It's crazy. And this sort of, I think, this kind of like vagueness and weirdness to the law really made sort of corporations sort of neurotic about race, because race and sex, because, you know, you never knew what was allowed and what wasn't.
Right, right, right. And it's this vagueness that allows for so much of what we've seen. So I think one of the things that really struck me was you're pointing out that before that case, if you were to hear people talk about the need for affirmative action or some sort of compensatory program, they would generally cite past injustices toward black people. They wouldn't say, well, diversity is our strength and it's a very important part of corporate culture, whatever. They wouldn't say that. But then after this case, which kind of allows you to consider race for that reason, all of a sudden it's everywhere. So if we're going to have an explanation for where this all comes from, that's going back to philosophers from a long time ago, then you're going to have to explain to me, why does the diversity obsession sprout at more or less exactly the moment when the Supreme Court says this is the one reason you can use?
Yeah, and I trace in the book that like you can look for newspaper articles about the word diversity and in the context of educational benefit. It doesn't exist before the Bakke case. The University of California was not arguing diversity. They were arguing for racial justice. And it's interesting because that's always, like the diversity stuff was always sort of fake. Like even though diversity became the official justification, deep down, like everyone was thinking about injustices against blacks. So in the SFFA v. Harvard case, now we're all the way in 2023, and the liberals on the Supreme Court, they're upset. And all they talk about is disparities between blacks and whites. They're not talking about, oh, you need this many Hispanics and maybe you have too many Asians. They don't mention Asians at all. People point this out. It was all just sort of a smokescreen and interest in racial justice, having, you know, a redistribution of wealth or redistribution of positions within society. And yeah, the diversity stuff, it was just sort of, you know, I think the Powell decision was just sort of like a political compromise, which is something you think legislators do, but like when judges do it, it leads to all kinds of strange results because that becomes the law, but it's just, you know, completely incoherent.
I have a question that I want to just bracket out from the natural progression of your argument. I just want to know what your thought is about this. It is true that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 expressly disclaims any intent to require racial quotas in hiring. But if, on the other hand, the spirit of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is clearly to expand employment opportunities for Black Americans, then couldn't I say, as an activist judge or as a grassroots activist, that it's really implementing the spirit of the Act of 1964 to have racial quotas, because there's no way I can know if somebody's discriminating because I can't read his mind. So we're going to have to rely on something very crude, namely statistical comparisons between the population and the makeup of your employee base. And so we're going to have quotas. How else do you propose we get rid of discrimination without them? Doesn't the 1964 Act naturally lead to quotas, in other words?
So yeah, there's two things there. There's like statutory interpretation of the law, and then there's a general policy argument of maybe having quotas or having some kind of affirmative action is a, you know, it could be beneficial. As far as the statutory interpretation, I mean, like, this is sort of what laws are for. People don't just have one goal, right? Help Black people. It's a trade-off, right? There's trade-offs, and people are thinking, you know, will this goal help African Americans versus freedom and economic growth and not engaging in reverse discrimination? So all of that was debated before the 1964 Act was passed. And, you know, people do resort to that argument because if they had the historical legislative intent argument on the side, they don't have another side. I mean, I show very clearly that everyone thought that this would be discrimination, just wouldn't mean discrimination. It wouldn't mean disparate impact. So, you could have a different policy argument. And if you're an activist judge, I guess, you know, nobody can stop you from doing it. You could say, well, there's so much discrimination against Blacks. We're going to make up for it to a certain extent. I mean, I think there's some evidence you could look for. I reject that because I believe markets work. I mean, most leftists believe that businessmen are entrepreneurs, are, you know, ruthless maximizers who just want to make as much money as possible. It's pretty strange that they would discriminate against entire sectors of the population, Blacks, women, even stuff like algorithms like loans. Like, why would, like, what's even the theory of why banks would discriminate in their loans, like, against Black people? It just makes no sense. You could look at the data that you can see, oh, wait, they were discriminating in favor of whites. You would see Blacks have a lower default rate, and you don't find that. And so, yeah, that's a policy argument. I mean, it's different than what people thought they were doing at the 64 Civil Rights Act. I don't think it's very good policy. And it's hard to sell to the American people. I mean, I think people, you have to sort of have this diversity. Everyone is benefiting here. A pure racial redistribution argument. I mean, then the colorblindness and the equal treatment and bringing, you know, African-Americans and non-whites into sort of the idea of an individualistic society, that sold well. And there was a societal consensus in favor of the Civil Rights Act. Maybe that's the way they've taken it because that's what they want, that they can't sell the honest argument, but I don't think it's a way to social peace. I don't think race relations and our politics are great as a result of what this race and sex discrimination system we've had over the last 60 or so years.
Well, I'll get to that in a minute because you have a section in your book called Civil Rights Law is Why We Hate Each Other. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
That's absolutely great.
Thanks.
But we shouldn't go into all four because people should read the doggone book, but let's go into a couple. You point out four particular, let's say, offshoots from civil rights law that have led to all kinds of difficulties. One of them, as we've already mentioned, is disparate impact. Now, Heather McDonald, earlier this year, released a whole book on disparate impact and showing how it's seeped out into the general culture. Just everything is held up to scrutiny in terms of whether there's a, you know, racially proportionate outcome, I mean, whether there are enough Black people in the symphony orchestra, even though the orchestras are doing all the auditions behind a curtain. So we know there couldn't be discrimination, and yet they're still obsessed with it. So disparate impact. So explain what disparate impact means and why it is the case that you quote somebody whose name I can't remember as saying that it makes potentially everything illegal.
Yeah. Gail Heriot, she's a UCSD law professor. Yeah, the disparate impact doctrine, I mean, it is what it sounds like. It's the idea that if you have some kind of practice in employment, it doesn't have to be employment, it's been applied to school discipline and other things too, where whites are advantaged relative to Blacks, whether that's you're giving a test or you're, you know, arresting how many people you arrest or police force or whatever, the presumption is there's something wrong with you. Now you can, in the business sense, you can refute it. You could have a defense and say there's a business necessity for this practice. But basically the burden shifts to you and that makes your life a lot more difficult if you want to justify the practice. Now what Gail Heriot says is, literally, you can't think of one thing that doesn't have a disparate impact. She's offered $10,000 to anyone. You know, you want to hire someone, Tom, who shows up on time and, you know, brushes their teeth. Not every group is going to be equal. I don't know what the numbers would be. But anything you want to do is it can have, you understand, it's not just black people versus white people. It's every, you could have a disparate impact, in theory at least, against every race or against either, any race or against either sex. And so, what does this mean in practice? What this means in practice is that government has a lot of discretion. If, you know, it's like everyone is, you know, the speed limit is 30 and everyone's driving 33 or 34, but the cops can pull over whoever they want. And this is like sort of the contours of like what's allowed, what's not allowed in American life. So like written tests, IQ tests, standardized tests, even like firefighting exams for people who, you know, want to be firefighters, those are suspect because, you know, some groups differ in how likely they are to pass those. But then college degrees, which also have a disparate impact, whites and Asians have more college degrees on average than blacks or Hispanics, that's somehow okay. Is there a legal reason why a college degree requirement is okay, but an IQ test for hiring is not? No one has ever provided one, and I've never seen any kind of justification for that. It's just government bureaucrats, civil rights lawyers, they like colleges a lot more than they like IQ tests, and this is why they're targeted. You have targeting based on what things that the civil rights administrators don't like, and then you have targeting based on which corporation is sort of in the news and which one has sort of got a target on their back.
Well, that same law professor you mentioned said something along the lines of, or actually, hasn't she challenged people to a bet $10,000 to your favorite charity? If you can find me a single employment criterion anywhere that doesn't have a disparate impact in some way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and nobody's ever taken her up on it because, yeah, I mean, a lot of this stuff is so illogical. I mean, these people are, nobody's bringing up these arguments. These people are, so, you know, like the diversity justification we just talked about. I think they just sort of like the implications of civil rights law. I'm talking about people on the left here. And they know that if you bring it up even to defend it, like it's really indefensible. So they take the flawed system as it is. Yeah, I think if you explain this to any liberal, they wouldn't have, you know, a good argument here.
Well, let's talk for a bit about another area that I wouldn't have expected to see in your book until I read about it. Then I saw how it fit in. And that is the concept of a hostile work environment, which has to do with sexual harassment law, which even the term sexual harassment, it's interesting to see the evolution of that term, how it came out of nowhere and then just exploded. How is this important to our understanding of woke?
You know, it's interesting. You go back to the Civil Rights Act, the sex discrimination part of it was sort of put in there as a joke to actually kill the bill because there was a segregationist who didn't like, he didn't want the Civil Rights Act to pass. He said, oh, 1964, American society is going to find the idea of no differentiation between men and women so ridiculous that this is going to kill the bill. Actually, the joke's on him, it actually passes. But the civil rights bureaucrats, the EEOC and others, they understand sort of the original intent behind the bill. So they don't do anything about sex until the women's movement, until feminism takes off later in the decade. And then for a while, like, it's just like, okay, you can't have like, in the newspapers, they used to have like a men's section, a job section for men and one for women. At first, they got rid of those. They used to have state laws, like some states would say men can work this amount of hours and women can work this amount of hours on the grounds that women might be, you know, more fragile or something like that. They force all the states to get rid of those laws. And then it's just like a few decades until we get sexual harassment. So the first cases, this seems like so obviously illegal today, but it wasn't clear to people for decades after the Civil Rights Act that just a quid pro quo, like saying, I'll hire you if you have sex with me. Like that wasn't clearly like in the text of the Civil Rights Act that that's illegal. So it wasn't until like the 70s and 80s that they even interpreted like that. But then it became more than that. It became, okay, the employer not only cannot, you know, offer a job based on a condition of sexual intercourse or something like that. It became more, okay, the employer can't treat employees according to stereotypes, can't harass the employees, must protect them from third parties, from other employees who might harass them. And then like what actually that means, that gets litigated. And the courts come up with a standard that says, okay, isolated jokes or whatever, that can't be, you know, that's not going to violate the Civil Rights Act. But if it's severe and pervasive enough, it can. Now, Yijit Bolak is a law professor at UCLA. And, you know, he says that, how is this going to be enforced at the level of the firm? The firm can't say, okay, you can make naughty jokes, but as long as it's not pervasive because you have to know what everyone else is joking too. So I'm like, I'm in an office with a lawyer, I make a joke or I do something. And they're like, the next guy, right? There's no way to enforce this. This is how you get zero tolerance policy. The zero tolerance policy work where like you can't like say anything politically incorrect. You can't make a joke. This is like a direct like logical consequence of this harassment law. And if you go into like case history of like stuff that's been like considered harassment. And the harassment applies to race too. It sometimes goes crazy, particularly in the area of sex because of dating and complications, stuff like that. But, you know, the EEOC gives guidance and they say stuff like, you know, jokes, you know, if you're in doubt about whether a joke is appropriate, keep it out of the workforce. Like there's a federal government agency telling you
what monitoring kind of, jokes.
Yeah, exactly. They're telling you can't, what they're regulating jokes at the level of the federal government in private businesses. And that's where we are. I mean, that's that nobody would have thought this was where civil rights law would lead in the 1960s. I mean, people were thinking discrimination in the 1950s, 1960s sense. The stuff, they never went back and changed the legislation. It was just the bureaucrats and the courts and the lawyers. I mean, this stuff took on a life of its own.
So I think, therefore, some people have drawn the conclusion that this all came from woke people in HR imposing things on the company, when in fact, that's more of a reflection of the existence of these laws that make it impossible for a business to be anything other than neurotic about questions like yeah. this. Now, on the other hand, that's not to say that there aren't woke people all through HR or that plenty of corporate CEOs absolutely do believe the crazy nonsense that they're saying. But even if we set that aside, we would still get the outcome we have now because the incentives of the laws and the interpretations thereof are going to lead a company just to protect itself and go down that kind of road.
People should remember that, like employers, managers, they're busy people. They don't keep up with every aspect of the law. So often they outsource their understanding to the HR, the lawyers. The HR people, they want to make themselves important. So there's an incentive, you know, there's an incentive here to really exaggerate what you need. And they're sort of a keeping up with the Joneses. They look at other corporations and they say, oh, look, they're inviting this anti-racist speaker. You got to invite this anti-racist speaker too. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that corporation, it's not that the HR people don't matter. I mean, you should understand them as their own sort of industry and sort of interest group who are, you know, sort of leveraging the laws to make themselves as important as power and as powerful as possible. Mm. But yeah, it was the laws that in the first place that gave them that position.
Hey, everybody, let me tell you about the upcoming Expat Money Summit hosted by Expat Money Show host Mikkel Thorup and two-time Tom Woods Show guest. Mikkel has lived everywhere, visited everywhere. He knows everything there is to know about international relocation and a whole bunch of issues short of international relocation, like second passports or banking offshore or whatever it is you're interested in regarding the expat lifestyle. And this whole event, which, by the way, features me as a speaker, is free. It's taking place October 2nd through the 6th online. You can check it out at expatmoneysummit.com. It is the largest offshore event in the world, and confirmed speakers include Ron Paul, Doug Casey, Mark Faber, Jim Rogers, me, also international lawyers, offshore precious metals dealers, foreign real estate experts, and much, much more. So we're going to be talking about finding a safe place to live in the world, legally eliminating your tax bill so you're not funding war, international wealth protection, second passports, offshore banking, and much more. So check it out by getting your free ticket at expatmoneysummit.com. That's expatmoneysummit.com. I want to read just a short little, this is just an anecdote, and the electronic copy I have wouldn't print out because I think that's like to protect your intellectual property.
They don't print to that. I didn't know they could do that.
So I just took an image of it and I printed out the image. But anyway, just because I want to read this to you. So sure. I know this is not typical, but the fact that this could happen at all tells us something. So this is the case in 2015, 2016, a black father and son. The father is Owen Diaz, and he's the one whose case finally made it to trial. So here's the thing. Racial slurs were used in the presence of Diaz, and he saw racist graffiti on a bathroom wall. It appears that the workers allegedly responsible were mostly or all minorities themselves, and each time an allegation could be verified, the employee was punished. So you'd think open and shut, no problem. The company did what it could. Tesla, which was the company, claimed they had taken enough steps to address the concerns of Diaz and also that he was a temp worker and not their employee. So the company was not responsible for protecting him from discrimination anyway. So they had already gone above and beyond. A jury disagreed and awarded the plaintiff $137 million,
right,
an amount that the judge reduced to $15 million. In response to the verdict, Tesla released a statement pointing out that witnesses confirmed that the slurs were used in a friendly manner, usually by African-American employees, and without hostile intent. Questions such as whether there can be such a thing as the friendly use of racial slurs and the parameters of what kind of flirtation is acceptable were once settled by private parties. Now they are matters of federal law. I just had to share that particular... because things like that just drive me crazy. The injustice involved in that.
Yeah. If you have like any kind of economics background, I mean, the idea that like your experience at a, you know, $20 hour job, now you're not insulting people who work those jobs, it could be very important. But like that experience, someone's using a racial slur against you, like, even if it was, if it were the worst case of what the guy is saying, this could be worth 137 or 15 million. My God. I mean, I think 99.999% of people would say, call me whatever you want for, you know, $100,000. Yeah. I mean, this is absurd.
Yeah.
You're right. And like, yeah, you have to really get into the minutiae. Okay, like I texted this girl like at this hour. I made this joke. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, you know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago. We were racially mixed groups. We would use racial slurs as, you know, friends. I mean, if the federal government found out about it, I guess, you know, they could have come after my school. There could have been lawsuits or whatever. But, you know, interracial sort of communication, like people's friendships, like their dating lives. I mean, these things are complicated. They're not these things that like the federal government or like courts should be deciding. Like the market and freedom of association should be able to take care of these things. I mean, a lot of people, you know, like the leftists, like won't see past like, oh no, you're criticizing civil rights or whatever. A lot of people won't see sort of like the radical libertarian sort of core of this argument, which is like, this stuff is too complicated and like freedom means making up your own decisions. And work is not that different from the rest of life. We take that attitude when it comes to like who you date or who you socialize with. We should be closer to that as far as the workplace goes.
I mentioned your section, civil rights law is why we hate each other. Now, it's true that if right now we were to pull the federal government rug out from under affirmative action, there'd still be plenty of woke companies. There'd still be companies that engage in the same policy. At one point in the book, I seem to recall, I forget what the case was, but there were hundreds of amicus briefs issued by companies that all wanted to join the pro-affirmative action side of the argument and zero on the other side. So there'd still be that. But nevertheless, at the very beginning of all this, I think it's very clear that the phenomenon in the first place was driven by the state. And then the private sector eventually came along. And now it's to the point where I think it would be very hard for some companies to disentangle from it because they've made it part of their corporate culture. But the initial impetus for it came from the state. It was not bubbling up through some cultural phenomenon or through the teachings of some philosopher.
Yeah, and that's one thing I stress. You know, it thinks the law matters, but it takes a while to shape the culture. And if we did everything I want in the book tomorrow, you know, all the HR people, all the crazy woke, you know, people, all the managers who came through these crazy universities, they would still be there and it would take some time to change things. Yeah, I think the chronology of like how this stuff happens is one of the most convincing aspects of the book. And if we do like do work on civil rights law, if we do repeal a lot of the bad laws and provisions, you know, I think that like they're not going to go out tomorrow and fire every single DEI officer. But next time there's a downturn in the economy and they're looking around and they're saying, who do we need, who we don't? I mean, I think that they're much more likely to be on the chopping block if they're seen as not financially necessary. And things can sometimes move faster than even you think, because there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, just like even the SFFA, the Harvard decision, it's about colleges. It's not about the private sector, which is a different area of law, but people are at least taking the hint that like, this is the way the Supreme Court is thinking about these issues. And even that, you're seeing sort of DEI seems to be in a, there seems to be, we're on the other side of sort of the boom that peaked around 2020 or so. And so, yeah, I mean, the market is a miraculous thing. You know, I believe in it as far as it, people do seek their own interests. I mean, that protects us against discrimination. It also protects us against ideological craziness when the government isn't there forcing people to behave in ideologically crazy ways.
Well, of course, disparate impact and some of these other things are more radical than just plain vanilla affirmative action. But even affirmative action has been unpopular. And what's interesting is that the recent Supreme Court case about affirmative action in university admissions was followed by, there was a poll done that looked at the opinions of people in all racial groups, men and women, all different demographic groups, and a majority in each of these demographic groups said they supported the decision and were against affirmative action in university admissions. So you have a policy that It's not just deeply unpopular among resentful old white men or something. It's deeply unpopular. And so many people have said, if somebody would just stand up against this, it's a political winner. And yet the natural party you would think would do that, if you hadn't had experience with this party for year after year, if you were coming from Mars, you would think the Republican Party would do something. And yet they've done so little. And you try in this book to account for, given that they're being handed a winning hand, they refuse to play it. Why?
Yeah. And so I spend a lot of time on this issue, partly because I'm interested in it, partly because I think most of these people who read this are going to be conservatives. So like maybe they're interested in this sort of history of the conservative movement and history of the Republican Party on these issues, because it's illuminating. And I think it like traces with some like developments, more general developments in our politics. So I break them down into a few eras, right? I say, first, you have till Reagan, there's no distinction between Democrats and Republicans. Oh, I mean, there is a little bit, but basically like Nixon goes further than LBJ, right? It's not like you elect Nixon in 68 necessarily, you know, you're going to get the more anti-affirmative action, the more anti-woke candidate. And this is because just like the bureaucrats and the judges and the media, I mean, the conservative movement, as we understand it today, conservative media really didn't exist. So there was this like leftist monoculture on these race and issues and on feminism. And so then Reagan comes along and Reagan wants to do something, but you know, we're sort of in a transition phase where the conservative movement is there, Ronald Reagan comes to power, and there's actual like a debate for the first time, do we get rid of the affirmative action executive order? There were people in this administration who wanted to, there were people who didn't. The Republicans in Congress were not going along with it. We were at the place where like the Republicans were divided. And in each step of the process, like the stuff from the last generation, it stops being a live argument, right? The stuff becomes codified. People just accept it as part of the landscape. They don't think about it as an issue anymore. And then we have basically a sorting thing happens where like Republicans become more conservative on like, especially on social issues, right? On guns, on abortion. And then when like we're not going to get any more like innovations in civil rights law coming from Republicans after George H.W. Bush, that's like impossible to imagine, but they've sort of forgotten about like what these battles were a previous generation ago. So you can't count on them to do anything good, right? They stand against like, even against like adding LGBT to anti-discrimination laws. They even stand against that in Congress. I mean, just because they've had it with civil rights, right? There's too much polarization between the two parties. And so now you're in this place where like wokeness just in the last 5-10 years just really gets in people's faces. And people are ready for the message that I'm bringing in this book. It's like these battles are worth revisiting, and it unites the conservative movement ideologically and just sort of temperamentally where they're going. It puts you on the right side of public opinion. And there's actual policy good about on the things that conservatives care about that you could do. So this history is not just Republican civil rights. This is a history of like a sort of a growth and maturation of the conservative movement, what we're seeing. And that's why we're starting to see some actual action on these policy areas.
How much of it is that they thought that if they could be perceived as not being so mean, if they could be perceived as not being resolutely opposed to every program that is ostensibly intended to help racial minorities, that then they would get a greater share of that vote?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that like how they perceive the public is going to perceive things and how the politicians perceive the things themselves really depends on the media environment. So like I look back at some of the debates in the 1980s where Reagan really tried to push back on civil rights law. And, you know, you'd read the Washington Post or something, you wouldn't get much detail. You'd be like, okay, the NAACP, you know, they won civil rights and Reagan is against civil rights. And like all you knew was like the liberals wanted the anti-racist thing and the conservatives wanted the racist thing. I think there's like an understanding that now conservatives can actually get their viewpoint across on, you know, whatever issue it happens to be. There's the conservative media to extent that's like it's like a bubble, but it also permeates, you know, liberal consciousness. Liberals can't just say whatever they want. They have to at least respond to what conservatives are doing and what conservative arguments are. And I think there's also just like, there's more sophistication that like affirmative action isn't necessarily the way to win minority votes. I mean, it's weird that like Trump does better with Hispanics. Every pundit thought that because Trump was anti-immigration, he'd fall off with Hispanics and Asians. And actually, Trump tends to do better than, or did better than Mitt Romney did. So I think that just like sort of this like, you know, groveling, playing to sort of racial grievance and like buying into the left on these things. I don't think people think, I think people are sort of realizing that's not the way to win minority votes.
So what does a program for reversing this look like? Now, I realize that's a, again, big chunk of the book, but at least what are some of the contours of it?
Yeah. So First of all, you could do the executive order. You could repeal or replace the executive order on affirmative action. At least one presidential candidate, Vivek Ramaswamy, has promised to do that his first day in office. I think the other Republican candidates will probably do something similar if it's on the radar, you know, if the issue is salient enough. You need to go against the disparate impact doctrine. There may be some complications to doing that through the courts, but it can be done. You could at least chip away on it. And I'm confident that, you know, depending on how bold you want it to be, you could probably get rid of it completely. You need a, like what the Republicans did on the Trump administration on Title IX. This is sort of the duration of the conservative movement. They really rolled back a lot of the bad Obama stuff on, you know, the Title IX kangaroo courts and these other things. And you could do this. There's this ping pong thing where Democrats come into power, they do one thing, and Republicans another. So, like, the Republicans should be doing the right thing when they're, you know, when they're in power. But the judges' legislation on these issues is impossible. They're too divisive. Just as a preserve of American politics, you should probably just, you know, activists like to act like, oh, we're gonna. Would you sign a 15-week abortion? Like, no 15-week abortion ban or anything on abortion is going to get through both houses of Congress, right? So I think people are living in a fantasy world. So that's why I set aside legislation on these issues. Yeah, but there are executive orders and you know, there's things you could do through the cabinets, the independent agencies, and then the judges are the most important thing. Every single one of these things is either, almost every single one of these things, is either created by judges or tolerated by judges, or judges decide which way the law is going, you know, whether the case is going to be, we're going to put the burden of proof here or we're going to be there, or how profitable the lawsuit's going to be, or what the standard of proof is for finding discrimination. I mean, this is the boring stuff that, like, you know, lawyers argue about. But yeah, there's plenty of opportunities to just be moving things in the right direction always.
But on the other hand, whenever I have legal authorities here on the show, they're very pessimistic about the condition of the law schools. And it's the law schools where we look to for lawyers who eventually become judges. And so, even if that were a problem we could not solve, nevertheless, at least we know where we need to look for the solution, even if in the short run it seems hopeless. But how do you respond to that, that the law schools are just in terrible shape? They're not giving us people who would do the right thing.
I mean, you don't need that many federal judges, right? With law schools, I mean, I think the majority of graduates have always been liberal, but we have a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court, and we have the majority of judges been appointed by Republicans. Luckily, there's some countries like, you know, you hear about the news, like there's just the judges appoint themselves, like there's an independent commission that appoints the judges. I heard about this, and this was Poland, and the elected government wanted to take away this power. And this was like in the media, like, oh, this is the end of democracy. Thankfully, that's not our system. Our system is the president appoints and then the Senate confirms. So, you know, if there's 50 conservatives graduating from law schools a year, you'll have a massive affirmative action in their favor because with elections.
Good point. Good point.
Yeah, they'll be the ones on the court. So yeah, the law schools, you don't have to worry, I think, that much about. You might have to worry about medicine or other things, but the fact that it's the president that appoints and the Senate that confirms judges, I think, you know, is a defense against that.
All right. I want to take a few minutes for you to say a little something about this. So just before the release of your book, a review appeared in The Atlantic that was, to everyone's surprise, deeply unfavorable. And of course, it consists of calling you all the usual names. Like, we all know. There was a time in my life when if I was called those names, I would have gone around and corrected everybody and explained, well, they're misunderstanding me. At this point, I feel like this is hopeless. A person of goodwill probably knows there's at least two sides to the story, or even more likely, these terms are just being thrown around carelessly as they always are. And I think I just more or less leave it there. But if I'm attacked in a high-profile outlet like The Atlantic, I nevertheless would hit back just because it generates buzz and interest, gets my name and my ideas out there. So can you talk to us about this review and, you know, how you're going to take advantage of it, I hope?
I did tweet about it quite a bit this morning and they got a little bit of attention. I don't know if, you know, I'll do much beyond that.
Okay.
But yeah, these reviews, you know, I appreciate that he's a smart guy, but also, you know, crazy and racist and that. So I at least got that. You know,
yeah, I don't usually get even that. I would be happy if they said, look, he's obviously very bright, but I didn't even get that.
So that's nice to get.
Yeah.
I knew this was the kind of book that I knew that, like, I'm touching the core of what emotionally motivates liberals, right? So, like, you know, he says, you know, I could go through like a couple like things that he says. You know, the guy says, oh, I say there's differences in standardized tests, IQ tests. Yes, that's like the whole point. That's why they're illegal in the first place. That's why we have disparate effect. Like, nobody denies that. He says that I dream of going back to a 1950s world where, like, you know, I guess, you know, people are groping their secretaries and stuff. I don't say anything like that. I say, like, you could have a more sort of either traditionalist or whatever you want to call it, frat boy culture, or you could be as woke as you want. I'm a libertarian, right? I want different kinds of institutions to bloom in the workplace. And I want people to go where they're comfortable, where they can make a profit and where they want to put their capital and where they want to spend their time. And so, yeah, I think that just the state of the media, I don't think this book is going to get, you know, a sympathetic hearing in the liberal press, but it brings attention to it. And that's part of the theory of the book. I mean, I sort of explicitly say, like, I just think liberals are gone on race and sex issues. That's why I'm talking to conservatives. I'm saying, Oh, this is the debate within the conservative movement. This is what conservatives have been doing. This is what they've gotten wrong. If I could convince liberals, that would be great. I just think we have this woke political culture now because some far smarter. I don't have a lot of fans in the MSN. You know, I correspond with them. None of them is going to write a favorable review about my book in The Atlantic because, you know, a lot of their employees or their coworkers are going to hate them. So I understand that. And I understand it's going to have to be sort of conservative political action that changes things.
Right. I'm really blown away that a book like this was published by HarperCollins.
Yeah. I'm working on an essay now about sort of the cancel culture and where it's gone. And I think that, like, you know, I think that people think, is it over? Is it not? I think it's more bifurcated. I think, like, the universities are just completely crazy. But I think anything where, like, you know, you have a conservative editor or a conservative magazine or, you know, anything that's, like, self-consciously, like, pro-free speech, it's just, you know, it's becoming sort of harder and harder to get canceled. So I think there's just, it's just a fragmentation of the culture more generally. These places where cancel culture is going strong as ever, it's been institutionalized, and other places where people just tune it out. An Atlantic article calling you racist is not going to matter or even be a plus. I mean, people will respond to that guy on Twitter and say, I wasn't sure if I was going to read it. Now I'm going to now, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of that out there too.
Well, one of my personal favorite things Trump ever did was he was on the White House lawn and a reporter said, so how do you feel about being called a racist today? And he said, who called me a racist? And they said, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he took his hand and he just swiped it away. He just said, who cares? His exact words were, who cares? And then he just walked away. That's the correct response because these people are not arguing in good faith. So there's no point in going down that road. So let me urge strongly that folks check out Richard Hanania's brand new book, The Origins of Woke, Civil Rights Law, Corporate America, and the Triumph of Identity Politics. I've got it linked in the description here or on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2395. There it is on the screen. Richard's holding his own copy. So thanks so much, Richard. Best of luck. It's an important book. Thanks for doing it.
Thanks, Tom. I enjoyed it.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.